Okay, I think we'll begin. I'm Julian Legras. I'm head of the Department of Social Policy at the London School of Economics, an ex-chair of LSE Health and Social Care, where the principal organiser of the Health Equity Network, Adam Oliver, is based. We'd like to welcome a particularly distinguished audience, and you're all here to hear a very distinguished speaker. Peter Bourne, who is currently a visiting scholar at Green College, Oxford, and prior to that was Vice-Chancellor of St. George's University in Grenada. He's had a glittering career, in particular two things I could just draw your particular attention to. He was Assistant General, Secretary General of the United Nations, a coordinator of the International Drinking Water Supply and Sanitation Decade, and he was Special Assistant to the President of the United States for health issues and director of the Office of Drug Abuse Policy, the first federal drug czar, to Jimmy Carter. He's had a long connection with Cuba of various kinds. In fact, originally being sent out by Jimmy Carter in 1979 to check out the effects of the health and nutrition of the US embargo. And later he worked, was commissioned by US foundations to look at the impact of the embargo on health and nutrition. And he's also written a biography of Fidel Castro, which he was telling me, and I hope I'm not going to spoil his story subsequently, that was entitled Fidel in the United States, but the British publishers said that they couldn't dream of labeling a biography by the first name, it would have to be called Castro. He's going to talk to us about the Cuban healthcare system, I've left behind his official title, but it's basically going to be about lessons from the healthcare system. So, Peter, over to you.
Thank you very much for your kind words. It's a great honor for me to be here. It's actually my first visit to the LSE, but I feel like it's been part of my life and awareness throughout my entire career, so I'm particularly happy to be here tonight. I'd also like to thank you all, so many of you, for being here at such a late hour in the day, and I regard that as a great privilege that you would come to hear me at this time. I have had this long involvement with the Cuban healthcare system. And one of the things that I find quite stunning is how unfamiliar the rest of the world is with what's happened in Cuba. There are many things about the Cuban healthcare system which I think other countries could learn a great deal from, and yet there has been very little written in English, and very few people, even people quite expert in healthcare in the US or in Europe, are really aware of what is happening in Cuba. I suppose the language barrier accounts for part of that, but I'm not sure that entirely explains it. I'm going to talk tonight about the system and just describe how it is in Cuba and how it operates. I'm also going to talk a little bit about its shortcomings, because there are problems that they have, like with every healthcare system, and many of the things that they're able to do in Cuba are not directly applicable to different political systems. So some of the things that work very well for them would not work in North America or in Europe. Perhaps the most significant aspect of the Cuban healthcare system is that there has been unrelenting commitment to making the health of the Cuban people the top priority of the government since the revolution came to power. There are many varying explanations of why Fidel Castro has personally taken such a strong interest in the health of the Cuban people. One story tells that he was, as a 9-year-old boy, hospitalized with appendicitis, and that there were complications, and he ended up being in the hospital for 3 months, and his parents lived many miles away, and they could only come to see him every week, and he was befriended by the hospital doctors and nurses, and this generated, therefore, a great interest in health. And he told people for a number of years that he planned to be a doctor. He, in fact, did not become a doctor, but continued to have a great deal of interest. Even as a guerrilla in the mountains of Cuba, he had three physicians who were fellow guerrillas with him. One, of course, was Che Guevara. And it is clear that during that time in the mountains, these three physicians prevailed on him in terms of the importance of making the provision of healthcare a top priority for the revolution. I think also he had, even though he came from a relatively affluent family by Cuban standards, he grew up in a rural part of Cuba in the most impoverished province. And I think he'd seen as a child what the absence of any form of healthcare meant to a lot of the poor people around them and how much they suffered. When the revolution came to power, when the constitution was written, a guarantee of healthcare was made a part of the Cuban constitution, and a commitment was made by the government to provide healthcare. In fact, Article 49 of the Cuban constitution says everyone has the right to health protection and care. The state guarantees this right by providing free hospital and medical care by the means of the installation of the rural medical service network, polyclinics, hospitals, preventive and specialized treatment centers, by providing free dental care, and by the health publicity campaigns, health education, regular medical examinations, general vaccinations, and other measures to prevent the outbreak of disease. All the population cooperates in these activities and plans them through the social and mass organizations. So from the start, it was in writing that every Cuban citizen could expect to have free health care that was accessible at the point of origin. So this was the fundamental commitment. Prior to Castro coming to power, there were roughly 6,000 doctors in Cuba. They were all white, they were all in private practice, and they were virtually all in the big cities. The poor in the rural areas essentially had no health care whatsoever. In fact, only 8% of the population outside Havana had access to health care. When Castro came to power, 50% or 3,000 of the 6,000 physicians left Cuba. In a way, it was a mixed blessing, because even though it meant that they had half the number of doctors overnight, it also meant that the medical establishment effectively crumbled, and you could start fresh and build something that was a new design without having to worry about the opposition of a medical establishment that surely would have opposed some of the things he decided to do. I think also one of the things that you cannot do looking at the Cuban healthcare system is really separate it from the rest of what the revolution set out to do, which was to create equity in a whole series of areas. And one of the first things that the revolution did was to try to implement universal literacy. Particularly in the rural areas, again, illiteracy was well over 50%, and the young people from the universities in Havana and the other cities were organized to go out and teach literacy to the entire population. And it is, in retrospect, looked back on like organizations like UNESCO as one of the most effective literacy campaigns that's ever been launched. And it was very successful. But one of the effects of it was that by suddenly then having an educated population, it meant that you could implement health programs and do health education with people that would have been very, very difficult and is very difficult in many developing countries where you don't have a population that's very literate. There's if you look at what they've done in Cuba, in a way, it's not very different from things that we know ought to be done. It's not that they've come up with any magic solution, that they've had any ideas that nobody else had had. But one of the things that I find is that when I take delegations of health experts to Cuba, the most common response I get from them is, well, this is what we've always been talking about, but they've actually done it. They've done it. So that it is the implementation of what many of us know will make for a good healthcare system that is so striking about Cuba, rather than some totally magical solution that they've come up with. One of my friends, who was head of the American Public Health Association, said to me that what he always says to people who ask, well, what is special about the healthcare system in Cuba, is, he says, well, they started by asking the right questions. And I think question number one, and it continues to be the question that they always ask, is how do we improve the health of the Cuban people? And how do we continue to increase the health of the Cuban people? And what impact will this intervention that we're thinking about making have on the health of the population as a whole? It is quite a different approach from a process approach, where you say, how many hospital beds do we need? Or how long a waiting list for surgery can we tolerate? Or what budget do we need? If you look in terms of what the goals are that you're trying to achieve, it is remarkable what different answers you come up from compared with if you just say, we're going to do these things with the system, and we hope that it will have some more general impact. The result of asking the right questions and saying, what can we do to improve the health of the Cuban people, means that you start looking very early at outcome measures and results. And the Cubans from the beginning started saying, how do we reduce infant mortality? How do we increase life expectancy? How do we reduce maternal mortality? How do we reduce the incidence of this disease or that disease? And in particular populations, everything that they did was geared to achieving those goals. And their success or failure in any intervention was always judged in terms of the results and the outcome. And that was then the sine qua non for them of whether their system was being effective. Early on, in order to provide immediate access to at least basic health care, one of the things they did to begin with was to establish 440 polyclinics. These were health centers that were placed all over the country so that every part of the population had relatively easy physical access to one of these centers. And they were staffed with physicians to provide primary health care and also with specialist backup, internists, pediatricians, obstetricians and gynecologists. And they provided first the centers, they then tied to that medical education programs because they were going to have to staff these centers. And then later on, health control in terms of public health programs and research, all tied together by the public information program. The The second not in the right order. The second really key issue was that the physicians were educated in a way to deliver healthcare that integrated the delivery of services with public health, so that you didn't go and just treat a person for a physical disease. You looked at the impact that it had on the whole community. So epidemiology was then made a central part of the way physicians practiced medicine. When I first went to Cuba in 1979 to look at the healthcare system, I went to one of these polyclinics and I said to the man in charge, "Tell me about diabetes in this community." And he immediately said, "Well, we have in this community, I don't know how many people with diabetes, and we have this program to identify all the people with diabetes that have not come in and are not symptomatic, and we have this program to screen people, and so on and so forth." If you'd asked a similar question from a physician in this country or North America, they would have immediately told you what dose of insulin they gave. So that everything in that sense is geared towards looking at a disease as a public health problem, rather than just in terms of treating the person who walks in the door of the health facility. Now, they also do that. I mean, they treat very well the people who come in, but it's not in isolation and it's not separated from the broader public health picture. In addition, the people in the polyclinics had a responsibility for things like environmental health, and much of their time was devoted to educating the population about good health practices, making sure that water systems were clean, that infectious diseases were controlled through mass vaccination programs. But it was the doctors and nurses in these centers who did the treatment, who were responsible, rather than a separate public health system that was unconnected to the delivery of services. They also worked with the political infrastructures, creating a local provincial medical committee, a municipal medical committee, and a national medical committee, so that if you had information that you wanted to get out to educate people, you had a system for communicating with everybody in the community. The result of this is that, for instance, if you had somebody who was pregnant, there was no way that they could then avoid getting antenatal care. And no woman delivers a child in Cuba without having had comprehensive antenatal care. This was one of the first things that began to dramatically change the infant mortality rate. Behind the polyclinics were 270 hospitals that were built up over about a 10-year period of time. And those were like hospitals everywhere else in terms of providing tertiary care. But they sent people outside Cuba to get very good postgraduate training and ended up with people who were really very competent. This is the list as of the year 2000. They now have, and I'll come back to this in a minute, 20,000 family physicians practicing in Cuba, 440 polyclinics as I mentioned, and the 270 hospitals. The maternal homes are obstetrical centers, and the delivery of children is essentially treated as a non-health problem, but as a biological function, so that you aren't considered sick and needing to go to a hospital unless there's a major complication. So that these maternal homes are near to where people live, and they are staffed by physicians as well as by midwives, although midwifery is not terribly well developed in Cuba, partly because they have such a large number of trained physicians. Prior to the revolution, there was only one medical school in Cuba, and that was in Havana. Beginning after the revolution, they began to build medical schools in every province. There are now 18 provinces in Cuba, and in all there are 22 medical schools. There are extra medical schools in Havana province, but every single province has a medical school. They have continued to produce from those 22 medical schools a steady flow of physicians over the last really 40 years now. And they have the highest ratio of doctors to population of any country in the world. There is one doctor for every 600 people in the country. It's a little bit more complicated than that because a number of doctors, because they have so many, are not in directly serving in a community. For instance, all 800 daycare centers for children has a physician attached to them, and that physician does nothing else but take care of the children in that daycare center. 700 employment sites have a physician who does nothing else except be at that factory or that work site. Every single school in Cuba has its own physician. So there is a real effort to monitor people's health and to provide health care for people wherever they are and at any stage in their life. One of the other aspects about the Cuban healthcare system which makes it quite unique and may have to do with the fact that perhaps healthcare is not very compatible with democracy, but it is a very, very flexible system, and it is because you have one person at the top, very committed to making it the best system it can possibly be, not having to worry about what will play in the next election, and just doing what they think is the right thing to do. And it's a very flexible system in which they're willing to try a variety of possibilities, many of which, by their own admission, don't work out. But they try them. If they work, that's fine. If they don't, they drop them. In 1980, the Cubans then decided that they needed to look at what was being done everywhere else in the world and see if they could learn something for the Cuban system from Britain and from North America and other places. And they sent people here to look at the NHS as well as to many other places. They felt their system was working, but you know, could be dramatically improved. They decided as a result of that review that went on, in fact, for 2 or 3 years, that primary care should be made absolutely the backbone of their healthcare system. And that in order to do that, they needed to have the large numbers of physicians that they have today and put a major emphasis on medical education and increasing the number of physicians. They also decided that the focus and expertise in primary healthcare should be significantly upgraded. So they then set about a program of creating physician, nurse, family, doctor teams, and they now have 20,000 of these around the country, so that each doctor-nurse team is responsible for 150 families, and they are responsible for those 150 families essentially in health or disease. It is their job to know every one of these families and their health status, to do regular screening for various diseases and try to identify any sort of health problems these people have at the earliest possible stage and then get them into appropriate treatment. This is a program which has worked extremely well for them. it provides a kind of continuity and care for patients. Each polyclinic supports about 30 doctor-nurse teams. And the polyclinic's function now is, rather than being the first deliverer of primary health care, it's the backup expertise to the family doctors out in the community. So they work in tandem with the family doctors, providing consultation in internal medicine or pediatrics or obstetrics and gynecology. And interestingly, every polyclinic now has a psychologist, so that they focus also on mental health issues as well as physical health. These family practitioners are not just doctors who've just graduated from medical school and been sent out in the community. They're required to do a minimum of a 3-year residency program in family health and family medicine before they go out into the community. They have created in Cuba a kind of a culture of making going to work in the least attractive places the most prestigious thing to do, which is quite a skill. But top medical graduates coming out of the medical schools will tell you proudly, I'm number one in my class, and therefore this means that I can go and work in the mountains in Oriente province. Whereas in most industrialized nations, people would say, well, I'm number one in my class, so I'm going to be able to stay in the capital and do a residency in neurosurgery or something. And so it's really quite the converse of the kind of value system that we're used to, particularly among physicians. The other issue, which is quite striking in Cuba, is the enormous emphasis that is put on the humanitarian aspects of medicine. They really inculcate students with a sense of dedication to humanity, which with the technological growth of medicine in the industrialized world, we've often gotten away from. One of the interesting things, there's a lot of issue about affirmative action and who gets into university these days, but the Cuban medical education system is 6 years of medical school, with the first 2 years being pre-medicine, sort of A-level kind of stuff of physics, chemistry, and biology, and then 4 years of actual medical education. But during your last year in high school, the students vote on which students in the class they think will make the best doctors. And this is based on saying, who is the most compassionate person? Who gets along best with people? Who do you think will be the most dedicated and most humanitarian? Somebody said that means that they must have no surgeons in Cuba, but it works very well for them. And that criterion carries a lot of weight in the selection process of who gets into medical school. Obviously, how well you've done in the exams and so forth also is important. But how your peers rate you in terms of the characteristics that they would like to see in their own doctor counts for a lot in whether you get in or not. Also, the whole notion of health being a responsibility of the whole community is something that is greatly emphasized. The family physician out in the community is sort of the leader of a movement to take care of health as a group responsibility. You know, people who, even things like smoking, the doctor sort of takes the lead but involves everybody in the community to try to get people to not smoke cigarettes, which is still a serious problem in Cuba. And issues like vaccination, the community will take on under the doctor's direction, making sure that every single child has been vaccinated and no child fails to get the basic set of vaccinations. An American friend of mine who has lived in Cuba for 20 years, was telling me last week that there was a knock on her door a few days earlier, and it was a local community worker there to tell her that she'd failed to get her mammogram, and that you know, everybody had to get a mammogram, and she was there just to remind her that she needed to do that. The results of this system is that since the revolution, since 1960, infant mortality has dropped down in a most dramatic way. It is now actually this year 6.0, which is on a par with most industrialized countries. I think it is right at about 6 in this country now. So that they really have done a very spectacular job. There has been a small rise, you see here, in maternal mortality, and that is a great concern to the Cubans. During the embargo, the American embargo, when they were having difficulty getting both food and medicine in significant quantities, they made a real effort to provide women with supplemental food, but nevertheless, during that period, some of the statistics did become worse, and there is a feeling that maybe this is some lasting effect from that. There is also a concern in Cuba, particularly on the part of women, that it's still a very male chauvinist society, and that many things, maybe in a rather nuanced way, happen to women that still adversely affect their health. Again, one of the things that's interesting with the Cubans is that when they have a problem, because of their lack of money, their lack of access to very sophisticated technology, it does force them to go back and ask these fundamental questions about the causative factors in various health conditions. And that is no more striking than it is with low birth weight babies. They have been very consciously aware of the problem of low birth weight and infant mortality. And whereas in the industrialized world, our solution has tended to be to develop more and more sophisticated technology to keep babies of lower and lower birth weight alive, the Cubans said, what are the factors that contribute to low birth weight? And they have an extremely sophisticated understanding of these factors, including now committing to the nutrition of women really from the time that they're young girls, not waiting and just doing it when a woman gets pregnant, but doing it throughout their life with the appreciation that it is health, the health of a woman throughout her life, not just what happens to her in pregnancy, that is going to affect her low birth weight. And that is one of the factors that has allowed them to bring down low birth weight and reduce dramatically the need for high technology which they can't afford. These are the diseases that they have eradicated with the years that they got rid of them. The three remaining are a pretty low prevalence now. And life expectancy is again on a par with most industrialized nations. This is an interesting but rather complicated graph that was done by the Karolinska Institute in Sweden. The size of each circle represents the population of that country. The region of the world is according to this color code. And along the bottom is gross national product per capita. And up on the side is five-year survival for children, up to age five, their survival. So that you can see in general the countries with low gross national product have the lowest survival rate, and they tend to be heavily concentrated in Africa, with the exception of India. But third world countries are down in that corner there. Finland, Sweden, Hong Kong, the UK, Japan, Germany are up in that corner there. They have high survival rate to age 5, but they also have very high per capita gross national product. And this is Cuba, which is in a very unique situation. Its gross national product per capita is relatively low, but their 5-year survival is very high. And they are very proud of this. And in fact, this chart was done 3 or 4 years ago, and it's even better at this point. The Cubans have had quite a lot of recognition for what they've accomplished. The president of the World Bank, James Wolfensohn, recently said, "I think Cuba has done, everyone would acknowledge, a great job on education and health, and it doesn't embarrass me to say it." Remarkably, at his Senate confirmation hearings, even Colin Powell admitted that Cuba had done an excellent job with their healthcare system. A United Nations Development Program study also recently said, an evaluation of 25 countries in the Americas measuring relative inequalities in health revealed that Cuba is the country with the best health situation in Latin America and the Caribbean. It is also the country that has achieved the most effective impact with resources, although scarce, invested in the health sector. One of the things that is happening now, and it is a really a whole new test for the Cuban healthcare system, that for all practical purposes, they are now on top of infectious disease, and the infant mortality rate is reaching towards the irreducible minimum. They are now beginning to address in a very systematic way chronic disease entities, and particularly the constellation of hypertension, diabetes, and renal disease. And they have a quite sophisticated health mapping system made available by the marvels of computer science, where they are identifying these disease entities even by house all over the country, and not only looking for clusters of these problems and looking for etiological factors, but it allows them to modify the structures of the polyclinics so that if there's an area where you have a particularly high incidence of people with hypertension, they can put somebody in that polyclinic who's a hypertension expert, or if there's an area where there's heavy renal disease, and people are going to need dialysis, they can place a dialysis unit where it has maximum accessibility for people. This is really just a summary of some things I've already said. The political commitment is really important. Health education of the population is important. You have a single health system. Of course, everything in Cuba is under the government. There's no separate health delivery. You have community participation in all of the programs aimed at prevention. And prevention itself is given a high priority. And then the human resources, the commitment that I talked about. In 1964, the U.S. imposed the embargo on Cuba, including food and medicine. It's a violation of Article 4 of the Geneva Convention and Article 12 of the UN Charter on Human Rights to in any way interfere with the free flow of food and medicine to civilian populations. It is the only embargo, including North Korea, Libya, Iraq. No other country has food and medicine been included. It is only against Cuba that this has been included. It posed problems for Cuba mainly in terms of things like getting access to cutting-edge antibiotics, which, most of which are developed in the United States and were covered for 17 years by patent law, so no other country could manufacture them. This effectively denied the Cubans access to cutting-edge antibiotics. But as long as the Soviet Union was around, it didn't pose too much problem for them because they could get a lot of these drugs from the Soviet bloc, not those drugs, but other drugs that they needed. And in addition, the Soviets were paying them an inflated rate in hard currency for the sugar crop, so they could go to European or Japanese pharmaceutical companies and buy drugs that, if they weren't exclusively controlled by the US, were available if you had the money to buy them. What happened then was that with the collapse of the Soviet Union, Cuban foreign trade dropped 80% in a year, and it created a catastrophic financial situation. It meant that the amount of hard currency available for buying drugs and medical supplies was suddenly dramatically limited. The man who was then Minister of Health told me that he would hold a meeting in his office every Monday morning, and they'd have a sort of a small amount of hard currency, and they would have to decide how much insulin they could afford to buy, how much antibiotic they could afford to buy, and so on. And they would have to make life and death decisions in terms of what drugs they would be able to get. To make matters worse, during that period of time, the US, in an effort to further tighten the bargain, the embargo, passed a law that banned for the first time US subsidiaries in Europe or elsewhere from trading with Cuba. Previously, it had been possible if there was a subsidiary of American pharmaceutical company in Europe, they could sell products to Cuba, but this ended that. Pharmacia, for instance, which was a big Swedish pharmaceutical company, was bought out by Upjohn. And they had been for years meeting a lot of the Cuban pharmaceutical needs. And after they were bought out by Upjohn, they had to terminate all trade with Cuba in 3 months. And so this created very, very serious problems. Even down to such things as the denial to Cuba of access to Kodak film for their mammography program, which they had been getting through intermediary countries. But they had a superb mammography program where every woman was screened every year. But the machines required a particular Kodak film, which for no other country in the world was it a problem getting access to. But they had to suspend their entire mammography program for 2 years because they could no longer get access to the film. It created enormous hardship for the Cuban healthcare system. What is remarkable is that they made a commitment at the top, in fact, by Fidel Castro, that no matter what else got compromised in the economy, they would do everything they could to try to not damage the health system or reduce these health statistics. And although there are few areas where things did go downhill for about 18 months, by and large, they were able to honor that commitment, and there was not significant decline in various health measures. There was one good thing that came out of all of this, is that the Cubans then, realizing how vulnerable they were, decided they better start their own pharmaceutical industry. And in the last 10 years, they have developed a pretty sophisticated pharmaceutical industry to meet their own needs. They've also been able to sell pharmaceuticals to other countries with quite a significant degree of success in generating substantial income for them. They have 12 research institutes, which are very sophisticated. The most prestigious is the Institute for Bioengineering and Biotechnology, which focus mainly on research relating to recombinant DNA. And they developed the first successful vaccine for meningitis B, or for meningitis and for hepatitis B. And in fact, now GlaxoSmithKline have worked out a deal with them to distribute the meningococcal vaccine worldwide. And that has been a major financial boost for Cuba. They are developing a number of other pharmaceutical and vaccine products, both for humans and for animals, that they are putting on the market. So what was a crisis at the time, and is to some degree a real problem for them, the embargo, there has been a bright lining to that cloud. Beginning in 1963, the Cubans sent a delegation of doctors to Algeria. This is just their medical schools. They sent a group of physicians to Algeria, even though they had very few physicians at that time. In part, it was a sort of solidarity move, but also because Fidel Castro felt that Cuba really had something to offer to impoverished people around the world, not just in Cuba. And from that initial beginning, they've sent over the years, since 1963, 51,000 health professionals to other countries. As of today, there are about 4,000 Cuban physicians in countries outside Cuba, and they are in 51 countries. There are 500 doctors, Cuban doctors, in South Africa, and nearly 2,000 in Haiti and Central America. They've also, over the years, been willing to take a certain number of medical students from developing countries, have them come to Cuba and go through the Cuban medical education system and then go back to their countries. Then in 1998, when Hurricane Mitch hit Central America and had a devastating impact, and the Cubans sent several hundred doctors there to all of the countries of Central America, they became aware of how few trained doctors there were in places like Honduras and El Salvador. And they decided to set up in the old Naval Academy in Havana what they're calling the Latin American School of Medical Sciences. And they are now teaching medical students from every country in Latin America, plus Equatorial Guinea, the only Spanish-speaking country in Africa. And because the heads of state of Mali and Nigeria said, well, why can't we send students? They have students from those two countries as well. With its full complement, it will have 6,000 medical students and will be the largest medical school in the world. And they will then go back to practice in their own countries in rural underserved areas. The governments of the countries they come from have to pay their travel, or they themselves have to come up with the travel. Cuba is providing them full scholarships to cover all of their costs in Cuba, living costs, all of the tuition and all the other education costs. And when I've asked them in the Ministry of Health, you know, how can you possibly afford this? And they said, we don't know, we're totally mad. but it is part of their sense of commitment that they should be doing this for the rest of the world. They have also then started medical schools in a number of other countries, staffed by Cuban physicians, and they have professors either teaching in existing medical schools or in medical schools they've started in 25 countries. They have particularly started significant medical schools in Guyana, Uganda, Benin, Ghana, Yemen, and Equatorial Guinea. And they will have a pretty significant impact on healthcare around the world. One of the things that's happening now, which I am encountering as I visit various developing countries, is that people who went to medical school in Cuba are now rising up in the health superstructure of their own countries, so that you're beginning to have ministers of health who went to medical school in Cuba. And so their model of what they want to do in their developing country is what they learned when they were going to school in Cuba. I just briefly want to say something about HIV/AIDS in Cuba, because initially the Cubans got sort of a bad press on this. When they first had people who were HIV positive, they did what every public health strategy had been in the past for dealing with things like tuberculosis. They quarantined the people and treated them, but the primary goal was to keep them comfortable and to keep them from infecting other people. The presumption was that these were people who were not going to live terribly long, and there wouldn't be terribly many of them, so they would make their life as pleasant as possible. So they were put in these quite nice facilities with color television and plenty of good food and so forth. The difficulty is that it quickly turned out that drugs came along that extended the life of these people, and the numbers grew. It became clear to the government this was a financial burden they couldn't handle. And in addition, they got a lot of negative publicity, because this was seen as a very kind of repressive and draconian measure to deal with the problem. In addition, it coincided with the period when the Soviet Union was collapsing, and a lot of the public in Cuba was saying, how come these people are living so well with all of this food and everything, and we're out here almost starving? And so there was a lot of resentment in the Cuban community, so that whole system was changed. Now, if somebody is identified as being HIV positive, they undergo an intensive 6-week education counseling program. They get, every single person gets free antiretroviral drugs, and they go back to live in the community. The total, as of the end of January, the total number of people in a population of 12 million, which is what it is in Cuba, there have been 4,538 people HIV positive or with AIDS. Of those, about 1,000 have died, and about 2,000 are still in treatment. I think, as far as I know, it's the lowest prevalence of AIDS in any country over 1 million people. I'm not sure, there may be some small islands that, where it's lower, but the prevalence in Cuba is lower than it is in certainly in any developing country, and in most developing countries as well. I just want to conclude by saying something about shortcomings of the system, and the Cubans are pretty open about what the shortcomings are. The biggest shortcoming is money. They've done a remarkable amount with a relatively limited amount of resources. The difficulty is that it has all gone into services and personnel. And so as a result, most of the physical facilities are literally falling apart. The hospitals need new roofs, the clinics need to be painted. They just need to upgrade the physical facilities. And that is not likely to happen any time in the near future. As the health system is entirely government-run, the fate of the health system is totally tied to the fate of the economy as a whole. And particularly after the bombing of the World Trade Center, tourism from other countries, not the US, but from Canada and other countries, to Cuba has gone down just because people are traveling less. And if there is, in fact, a war with Iraq, the price of oil will go up and will have a devastating effect on Cuba. One of the other problems is that Cuba, by Cuban terms, pays its doctors quite well. Compared to the rest of the world, they're not well paid. So that if there is ever a situation where Cuban doctors can leave in large numbers, then the stability of the situation, the system, would be in serious threat. They have not had a great deal of problem with the doctors they've sent overseas. They have about 5% who don't come back, and they just write that off as, you know, understandable and to be expected. But Cuban doctors have difficulty getting licensed in the US or here, so the opportunity to go and practice somewhere else, even though they're very well trained, is small. But they are very aware how vulnerable they are on this issue. They have also become very concerned about the shortage of nurses, which I guess is a global problem, and that the ability to attract people to go into nursing, I think particularly when they have trained such a large number of physicians, is a problem for them. Another issue is that they had never created any sort of career ladder for nurses. There was no master's degree program or PhD in nursing, no nursing specialization. You were just a nurse and you just got assigned wherever you were needed. They are now trying to build in a higher education system for nurses and a specialty system so that there is a career ladder with that people can work their way up and get better pay. Some of their prevention programs just haven't worked. They put an enormous effort into trying to stop people smoking, but it really hasn't been very successful. And they attribute it to the fact that they are a tobacco culture, and that tobacco has been such a central part of their culture for so long that it's very difficult to stop people smoking. I think there is also an element that if you live in an impoverished country, where even if your healthcare and education is very good, and there aren't many opportunities for other pleasures, that cigarette smoking becomes one of the few pleasures that is accessible to you. And the motivation then to not smoke is reduced quite substantially. Finally, the last issue has to do with the future of the man who made it all happen, Fidel Castro. He, as he's gotten older, particularly in the last few years, it has become more and more apparent how much he was involved in all the decision-making in the healthcare system. He can quote off the top of his head the infant mortality rate in every single province in Cuba immediately. He is totally involved in what has been done in the healthcare system. In most developing countries, the Ministry of Health is completely at the bottom of the totem pole. The head of state has little or no interest in the healthcare system or gives it only lip service. People in the healthcare system in Cuba are quite worried what will happen when he leaves. Those who are likely to successors promise that they will try to maintain it the way it has been, and people will still benefit. But that sort of remains to be seen. Whether in fact it will be sustained. I think that there are many things that we can learn. I mean, the things that are really unique is that if you want a good healthcare system, the person at the top has to be seriously committed to making health a priority. As I said, it doesn't lend itself to the usual give and take of electoral politics. The person has to take it out of politics and say we're going to do the right things regardless and do long-term planning. The integration of preventive medicine with healthcare delivery is another thing that is crucially important in the effectiveness of the Cuban system. We used to have it in the industrialized nations, and then it sort of separated apart, and public health was over here, treatments over here, and they really don't interact. The focus on primary health care and the training of large numbers of physicians in an organized way to meet the health needs of the population is very important. Having a very high physician population ratio where people can have immediate access to physicians with minimal barriers, or particularly geographic barriers. The continuity of care is extremely important so that the person feels responsible for you throughout, for maintaining your health as well as just treating you when you're sick. The very strong humanitarian commitment, which we have increasingly lost, probably much more in the United States, where money and high technology have very much taken over the traditional values in medicine, and particularly high flexibility and constant assessment of the success or failure of the system, and a willingness to change and try new things have been critical in Cuba, and those are things which I think other countries could also benefit from. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Indeed, Peter. Well, we have been we have the opportunity now to any questions. We have quite a few minutes, so just over there. Perhaps I could ask people to identify themselves, and there will be microphones going around.
Kate Clayton, I'm an art therapist, so I just was. In mental health, and I'm just
wait for a moment. Just wait till this is finished, and we can't hear you very well.
I'm just curious about the mental health provision, if there is choice of treatments for people.
Yes. There is a, as I mentioned, a psychologist now in every polyclinic, but they also have a separate mental health system with mental health clinics. In a way, it's been in advance of the general health system, because from the beginning, these mental health clinics were set up, each one slightly different, to meet the needs of the population in the area they serve. The polyclinics, for a long time, were just all the same, all over the country. Whereas these specifically targeted all of the services that you would find anywhere else that the Cubans have adopted in Cuba, and all sorts of therapy for the mentally ill are available, and they have the equivalent of a sort of state hospital in Havana for it's where everybody used to be sent, but it's now really for sort of chronic schizophrenics and so forth. But it's quite impressive to go there, because they make an effort to have every single patient do something constructive. So that even the most retarded schizophrenic has some repetitive job that they go to every morning, and they just sit there and do whatever it is. But they don't let anybody go off and sit in a corner all day long like that. Yes. Let me just say one other thing, if I could. Which just reminds me of something I might have mentioned earlier. Because of the embargo issue, they also have taken a great interest in complementary medicine. And they have done a lot of research, and there is an effort now to integrate it into the medical school curriculums. They are quite sensitive about it, because they are worried that outsiders will criticize the Cuban healthcare system on other grounds, and then say, and they're doing all this crazy acupuncture and herbal medicine, and you know, that just shows that it's not a very good system. So that they are very careful about having to have scientific validation of any sort of complementary medicine. But they have incorporated it in a way that's quite advanced, even compared to most developed countries.
Hello, my name is Theodore, a student at Imperial College. You mentioned at some point the lack of democracy in the political system, and I was wondering how much democracy there exists within the health care system. How much input do the doctors get to give in the design of the policies, and the people themselves as well? Thank you.
It's in some ways it's a mixed picture, but the in a way you can argue that they have more input than they do in most other systems, because there is a health committee in each community. If the community is unhappy with the community doctor, they can request that that doctor be removed. So there's quite a motivation for the doctors to keep goodwill with the community. There are countless meetings where they try to get feedback from the family physicians. And one of the reasons that they have really changed their attitude towards making family physicians the backbone of the system is that the family physicians were complaining that they were kind of looked down on, that the people in the specialty hospitals would treat them dismissively when they were the people seeing the bulk of the patients every day. And the decision was then made for that reason, but other reasons as well, to upgrade the skills of the family physicians, and so that they could treat people in a much more sophisticated way than having to refer them to the polyclinic or to a hospital. So there is, I think, pretty good input. You can argue that, if you're number one in your class and you get sent to the mountains in the Sierra Madre to live for 2 years under very unhappy physical circumstances, that there's not much democracy in that. And it's quite hard to tell whether people genuinely do want to go there because it's kind of prestige and that's where the top person in the class wants to go, or whether people don't really dare criticize it. You know, maybe they don't want to go, but they don't want to seem to be against the system. That is a more subtle distinction. My impression is that people really do believe that that's what they want to do, and they are. It's only for 2 years, and then they come back and do something else. So, I think there's pretty good democracy in the system.
As you said yourself, the translation.
Could you just identify yourself?
That's working.
No, could you just identify yourself?
Sorry. I'm Eric Brunner from UCL, University College London. You said yourself that the translation from the Cuban context to the European context is not straightforward. And what struck me in your fascinating lecture was the fact that if we wanted to have a primary care system like the one in Cuba, then we'd have to have about three times as many GPs in this country than we do at present. I wonder whether you could identify perhaps the most important single lesson that could be brought to the UK or to other European countries.
Yes, well, you're absolutely right. And, you know, yes, you would need three times as many or more. And then the issue would be the cost. And I think most governments would say it's unaffordable. So, it would not be a starter. And the Cubans can do it because it doesn't really cost them hard currency to train doctors and they can pay them very little. I think probably the most important thing of all is the integration of public health with service delivery, that we really have allowed those things to drift so far apart. And you have people working on public health like it has absolutely nothing to do with the treatment of patients. And, you know, I know there are people at this institution very much looking now at the social aspects of health as there are in other institutions as well. But I not only feel that that is an extremely important element in healthcare delivery for the future, but I feel that in Cuba, this is something that people have been doing for a very long time and have a very sophisticated understanding of it. In terms of just income equity, the income disparity in Cuba is sixfold from the most highly paid to the lowest paid. I don't know what it is in the UK, but it's 250 in the US. And, you know, we know that those things correlate with bad health outcomes. So that, you know, they are very consciously aware of that. And I think that the whole notion that you worry about the disease in the community rather than just the person who walks in the door with symptoms of the disease. I mean, part of it's prevention, but part of it is just a kind of epidemiological conceptualization of what's out there. Those are the things that we can grasp. There was a group, some of you may be familiar with this, there was a group of 200 NHS general practitioners who went as a delegation to Cuba about 2 years ago. And those who were on that delegation that I talked to felt that it was an extraordinarily beneficial learning experience for them. And I don't know that they can necessarily summarize what it was that's going to affect how they practice here. But, you know, I think that was a very successful trip, and I think to have more people go and do the same thing would be very good. But,
I'm a physician, I'm a type 2 physician, foreigners are being branded as type 2 physician. Dr. Peter, it is very nice that you sent us your slides ahead. So being a latecomer, like the Cuban continuum of care, I could attend your lecture with ease. Thanks, Mr. Oliver, for the seat here, okay? In fact, your lecture clearly showed us that if at all there is a shoulder-to-shoulder relationship between the two islands, it should be between British and Cuban. And yes. It is not with cooperation of military, it should be healthcare. Yes. So I got a few, one question and a few suggestions. Question is that, why is that? See, there is a surplus of medical professionals in Cuba, there is a death of professionals in this country. Why is that the political leaders or the medical politicians very hesitant to globalize the medical education so that any medical graduate, apart successfully completing his degree, even that is Zimbabwe, medical graduate could come to this country or Cubans could go to Canada, if not to US. What is wrong? Who you could initiate?
Yes. Well, it's a very good question, and there are some totally mad situations at the moment where there are 400 Cuban doctors in South Africa, and the UK is recruiting doctors from South Africa.
Yeah.
As you may know, 40% of the practicing physicians in the United States are from the Indian subcontinent.
Slaves.
So it's become...
That's because I talk like this. I'm as far as them. I'm suffering. Yeah.
So that, you know, you really have a globalization of healthcare, and I think we are seeing a breakdown of the system. In fact, one of the people who apologized to me for not being able to come here tonight is Dr. Cato, the president of the GMC, and he said he was very interested in the Cuban system because Cuban doctors are having such an impact around the world now. And this may be the worst analogy, but I think that we sort of have to move more towards the driving license kind of model for doctors. If you know your stuff, and you can pass the best tough exams, then you should be able to have universal access to practice anywhere you want. You don't, the driving examiner doesn't ask you which driving school did you go
exactly.
to. And you know, if you didn't go to the right driving school, then you can't drive a car. And you know, the only thing that the patient is interested in is, do you know your stuff or not? And are you going to be a good doctor for me? You know, a change is occurring, but it's slow.
Slowly, yes.
And all of what's going on is part of that process. I think 20 years from now, the picture may look very, very different.
Suggestions on
that? I think we'll move to another question. Thank you.
Okay, the primary care in this country is very poor, so you can suggest these
yes.
people to integrate
the Thank you.
Yeah,
well,
the program to this
yes.
primary care program. That's
well, I mean, again, this may not be the best way to promote the healthcare system, but I just recently heard that during the foot and mouth epidemic, Cuba offered to send some vets here, and they were accepted. They were accepted, and they went and they did their vet thing somewhere in the north. But being associated with the foot and mouth epidemic may not.
And finally, I hope that the British will do by all of their means, shoulder to shoulder, to get the economic talking so that people will really have a good future. Thank you.
Yes.
Lovely to
Yes, sorry.
Thank you. My name is Harun Rashid. I'm a GP in the NHS in East London. I'm a student here. Such impressive statistics on infant mortality, MMR under 5. Given in almost 46 years of U.S. sanctioned blockade. What is the psychology behind this continuation, where Vietnam is not facing yes. that? I mean, given your experience in during the Carter administration.
Well, it's all very simple. It's called Florida. and it has entirely to do with the electoral process and the role that the Florida primary plays, and the fact that it is a crucial swing state in the election. George Bush would not be president had he not catered appallingly to the Cuban-American exile community in Florida. There is also, and I didn't get into it, there's also a sort of a racial element in all of this, because Cuba is now probably 65% African American. The exile community is 95% white, 5% of African descent. A lot of the hostility is a feeling on the part of people in Florida that they have had, you know, a privileged life taken away from them, and that they, A, sort of want a sort of vengeance, but there's also this magical hope that one day Fidel Castro will be gone and they'll all be able to go back there. But it comes down really to every American president having to play to that constituent of Florida. If the Cubans had settled in Montana, it wouldn't be an issue at all, or anywhere else. It's because they happen to be in Florida. Florida plays such a critical role in the American political process.
My name's Andy Crowcock from Brick Lane. Do you think the embargo has helped the help figures by making it organic?
Well, as I mentioned, it has created some self-reliance. If they had been able to get all these drugs, well, they would have continued to just buy them from other places. There are still things that they cannot get. For instance, nearly all heart pacemakers are made in the U.S., and things like the X-ray film, and there are the patent issues on newly developed drugs. But they have developed quite a sophisticated industry that they just would not have if the embargo hadn't forced them into it. I think it also, you know, they get some sympathy around the world. Every year it comes up in the UN, and the US is condemned for the embargo, you know, 159-2 or 3, and it's, you know, the US and Israel and Micronesia or the Marshall Islands or somewhere. Overwhelmingly, the U.S. is condemned, and you know, there's some political mileage in the international arena for Cuba in terms of getting sympathy from that. But on balance, you know, it devastates their economy, and I think that they would have been delighted to get rid of it. Oh, you mean organic agriculture? Yes, yes. No, that's actually a very impressive part of what they're doing. I've only been to one of. Yes, well, that's right. I've only been to one of their organic farms, but it was an extremely impressive place, and people with more agricultural interests than me tell me that what they're now doing is really kind of pathfinding in agriculture, and as an element in health. So yes, I think the embargo made them do that, and that's another very positive outcome of it.
RV's program, you said it's universal access. And you said there is a small number of patients, but I wonder if the affordability is related to local production of the drugs as well? Of antiretrovirus.
You mean the accessibility of...
That there is now access to RVs to all the patients in Cuba.
Yes.
And the reason why Cuba is being able to afford this is because the drugs are being produced in the country or because...
Cuba, yes, I'm not a great pharmacologist, but I understand the production of RVs is not very complicated, so that they were able to manufacture them fairly easily. Quite enough for everybody who's HIV positive in Cuba. They have also offered to provide a substantial quantity to various African countries, including South Africa, but it's got all sort of mixed up in the politics of AIDS in South Africa. But the Vice President of Cuba last year spoke at the UN special session on AIDS and said as an initial gesture, Cuba would give enough antiretroviral drugs for 30,000 patients in Africa, and they would give them free. And so yes, this is a very important element of making the treatment available.
Hi, I'm Jose Fernandez from LSE Health and Social Care. You described a situation of great scarcity. I was wondering whether you could say a bit more about the process by which allocation resources are taken. You know, who, what to provide and to whom?
The decisions are made all the way down. During the period of most scarcity, even the smallest decisions were made in the office of the Minister of Health because there was so little to divide. But now that the acute crisis is over, most of those kind of allocation of resource decisions get made by the province medical director. And there are 18 provinces. So they will then allocate, make the decision on the allocation of resources. If you're talking about how many physicians do we train, that sort of major strategic decision. They have a number of emeritus ministers of health, people who are top professors at the universities, and they have innumerable committees that constantly meet to advise the government on what they should do in a whole variety of these areas. And they put together essentially this blue ribbon panel in 1980 to travel the world and come back with the best ideas that they could find and formulate a set of recommendations for the government.
Command
and
control. Anna.
Yes, Anna Coop from the King's Fund. I was curious to know about the relationship between the health system that aims to improve health rather than just provide health care and the Cuban economy. I mean, is there any evidence, first of all, that having a relatively healthy population impacts positively on the Cuban economy? And are there any signs or any evidence that the government pursues this policy of safeguarding its own health system for economic reasons? Not just the advantage they would get from selling drugs abroad, but because it's good for the economy and they know that it is.
I'm sure there are academic economists in Cuba who could give you a precise answer on that. But there is data from all over the rest of the world that a healthy population benefits the economy. And in fact, the UN recently has been saying that healthy populations are really a key to the development of a lot of developing countries. So that it is extremely important to make health a priority rather than improve the economy and then afford the health. Yes, well, as I say, I think that's probably part of the thinking. I can't give you a specific study in Cuba as to whether it impacts the economy in a measurable way. But the fact that you have such a healthier population, that you have in most major employment centers physicians assigned to factories and so forth, makes me think that they must have good evidence that there is a direct correlation between economic productivity and the health of the population. You actually remind me to just mention one other thing. They're trying an experiment now in Oriente province. When somebody gets treated, they're giving them a bill for what their treatment cost. And then they say, but you don't have to pay it. Because there is a lot of concern that people just take the health system for granted, that it's free and it costs nobody anything. And they want to begin educating people that you may not have to pay at the point that you get the services, but somebody pays at some point in the system. And they want people to understand that and appreciate that there is a cost involved. And they're doing it in one province to try it out, and if there's too much negative reaction, they may not extend it further. But it's something that they're just testing now, because particularly the economists are worried that they're creating a society where there is an erroneous assumption that something that you don't pay for at the moment of delivery is therefore of no cost to anybody and is totally free.
We'll just take two more questions. I think we'll...
Yes. My last name is Ture. I'm a student at the LSE in Destin. My question is basically dealing with the Cuban people. Unfortunately, I had a very short stay in Cuba when I went, but it was quite clear that the influence that that Florida had on Cuba was quite strong. And I know for myself, I can't wear a Che Guevara t-shirt when I'm in Miami. So basically, my question is dealing with the future. There is a lot of prediction that Cuba in a couple of years may not be the Cuba that we know today. What do you think will be the future of the progress made by the revolution?
Yes, that's a very good question. And I think it's really anybody's guess is the simple answer. But there are a lot of interesting things happening. For one thing, the attitudes in Florida are changing very significantly. You've got a new generation coming along that are not exiles, and they would like to normalize relations with Cuba. Some candidate, a Cuban-American candidate, ran in the last congressional election for a congressional seat in Miami and got a third of the vote. Now, she didn't win, but to get a third of the vote on a platform of lifting the embargo and normalizing relations in Miami is an incredible change from the way that it used to be. You also, in Cuba, have a new generation of leaders coming along who are kind of frustrated with the old guys who were in the mountains and who are hanging on to power, and they want to take over things. I think when there is a change and you have some of these people, many of whom are in their 40s, take over power, you will see quite a significant change in the Cuban system, particularly opening up to a more market economy. They're already doing it in many ways. I mean, there are many joint ventures with large, the Melia Corporation has big hotels in Cuba, and a lot of other, Sheraton International in Canada, a lot of big corporations are now working with the Cuban government. So I think you'll see a change. They all say, we want to preserve, no matter what we do, we want to preserve the healthcare system, the education system, and the social net for old people. We don't mind terribly if we don't have such a centrally planned economy, or if we get rid of the Marxist rhetoric, or we have more free enterprise. And I think that's the direction you'll see it going in.
Last question, in the middle there.
Yes.
Hold on 1 second, we'll just wait till we get there.
Hi, my name's Josephine Osikana. I was formerly a volunteer for the Bretton Woods Project. I'm just interested in the ratio of female physicians relative to their male counterparts, and what areas female physicians specialize in the Cuban health system.
Yes, overall, it's now about 60% female among all doctors. You know, I think a lot of the specialization there are sort of the traditional things that women's physicians go into, because often they want a life apart from doing medicine all the time. So that it does tend to be things like pediatrics and obstetrics and primary health care. But there are some in neurosurgery and thoracic surgery, but I think you know, I think the profile of specialties really isn't any different from what it is in an industrialized country. I just want to say one last thing, if I may. Out of all of the stuff that I've been doing in Cuba over the last many years, I have, with a Cuban colleague, set up a program to enable American medical students to go to Cuba for six-week electives. And I won't bore you with all the incredible political and legal obstacles that we had to go through to do that, but we've now sent 500 American students to Cuba to spend 6 weeks with a family physician out in the community. And all of those students have come back and thought it was one of the most valuable aspects of their whole medical training. And we hope that through that we will at least shape the American educational establishment in some way and make them a little more favorable towards adopting the Cuban model. Thank you. Well, thank you very much, Peter. Just before we close, I would just like to say this is the first annual lecture in the Health Equity Network series. We hope it's going to be a series of lectures, and we hope very much that you will attend subsequent ones. I would just like to say a quick word of thanks to, first of all, to Franco Sassi, who helped organize this, but more particularly to Adam Oliver, who has been the driving force behind this event, and we are very grateful to you, Adam, for doing that. Finally, I visited Cuba not so very long ago, and I remember being very impressed by a poster that said that 15 million children were sleeping on the streets in the world, and not one of them in Cuba. Peter, you've given us a set of equally impressive, in fact, even more impressive facts about Cuba and the Cuban health system, and many lessons that we can learn, not least that Florida has got a lot to answer for. Thank you very much.